Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I think about it for a few days and I put the podcast up here on the podcast feed. Special thing happening this time out, though, is that I'm recording this live streaming video from Ustream.tv. So if you want to see this, you can press pause now and actually go and watch me do this. And you can see me hold the book up and just generally talk to the camera. Maybe you find that a little bit more interesting. Maybe not. So just stick with it. So if you want to look at that, go to ustream.tv/channel/ Luke Burridge. And you can watch me there. In other words, in the future, I really do enjoy doing this. So in the future, I will be doing it more. So follow me on Twitter because I sort of throw out the updates there and nowhere else. So I just realised that my laptop's not plugged in properly, and I don't know why I didn't realise that. So what you need to also know is that I won't be doing this. This will actually be one of the last live streaming shows that I'll be doing for a while. For the reason for that is on Thursday, which is in 2 days' time, I'm going to be leaving home for 8 weeks. And, because of my work, I've got three cruises lined up in a row, one for 3 weeks, one for a week, and then one for 4 weeks. And so that means I'll be traveling a lot, which means I won't be doing these live shows. But also it means I'll probably be reading a lot and writing, which I'll get onto in a minute. I, of course, will be taking some books with me, but what I really like to do is read on my iPod or my iPhone. I generally, when I'm traveling, because I had an iPod Touch and now I have an iPhone, I listen to music and do bits and pieces on the iPhone, but reading with the screen turned on all the time uses up the battery quite a bit. So what I do is I take my iPod Touch along with me so I can sit there listening to music on my iPod or on my iPod Touch. Either one doesn't really matter, but I can read on the one which has got the most battery left on it, which is generally my iPod Touch. So that my iPod Touch is becoming my book reader and music listening, and my iPhone is becoming my podcast listening device and general internet stuff. Anyway, so send in your suggestions for ebooks that I've not yet read. I was listening to the Sofanauts podcast, the latest episode of Sofanauts, and there was a guy on there called Peter Watts, and so I downloaded straight onto my phone Blindsight, which Tony from Science from the Sofanauts or Starship Sofa, he didn't enjoy and didn't really get into it. So it's probably going to be quite a complex book. I'm not entirely sure what it's about, but the way they were talking about it, it seems a little bit complex. But I'm sure it'll be a good one. I'm not saying that I don't share Tony's views in science fiction at all, but you know, we have divergent tastes sometimes, so I'm sure I'll enjoy it. And the other thing that I could do is on the cruise ship that I'm going on next, I know that they have Atlas Shrugged by Anne Ryan and I can't even remember how to pronounce the name there. Anyway, so it's a huge book. It's massive, and I've never really felt like reading it before, but I've got 19 days on this cruise ship to fill up. So I'm thinking of reading that, and also because of the book that I'm going to be reviewing today, it's a very sort of political kind of book, is Atlas Shrugged, and it's sort of like setting out political philosophy and all that kind of stuff. So I think it would be quite a good companion to The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin, which is what I'm going to be reviewing today. Find a little bit of news. It's the National Novel Writing Month. This is the first podcast that I've done since beginning that. I'm about 18,000 and something words into it, which actually puts me a few days ahead of schedule, which is good considering that I only wrote a few hundred words yesterday and no word today, and I probably won't write anything today at all because I've only got a few days left at home until the end of the year, and I've got better things to do. I need to pack and get stuff sorted out and go shopping and loads of different stuff and meet friends, of course, which I'll be doing in a few minutes when I finish this. I'll be going straight out and doing that. NaNoWriMo is going really well, and I might mention a bit of that later on in the podcast. I did have a bit of feedback, but I've gone on long enough already at the beginning here, and I have not got to the review, so I will skip forward to my review. So one of the main reasons that I read this book, not only is because I read The Left Hand of Darkness and really enjoyed it and thought, hey, I need more Ursula K. Le Guin in my life. So, of course, lots of other people recommended it too. But also there's this podcast that I'm listening to called Science Fiction and Politics. And what happens is this guy called Courtney Brown, he's a professor at I think it's Emory University. I mean, I've listened to half the episodes. I should know by now. And what he does is he goes through novels with his students and he talks about the political aspects of the novels. And you know, he's doing this politics course or mathematics and politics. I can't even remember what it is now. And yeah, so he's trying to teach his students how to look at the politics of the world through the eyes of the politics in the books. And there's a long list of books. I've read most of them, but one book that I hadn't read, so I skipped over those lectures and went back to it, was, of course, The Left Hand of Darkness, and another book that I've not read, which is this, The Dispossessed. And there's two other books on there that I've not read, which I will get to again. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I reread Aldous Huxley's Brave New World as well, because again, I'd read it before, but it was there ready to read, and I thought, oh, they're doing this in the podcast that I'm going to be listening to. So really enjoying that. And coming up, of course, is The Dispossessed. So as well as all the recommendations, listening to that podcast, it's a pretty good podcast. I mean, it's not massively interesting, but I might talk about it a little bit more in the future. Actually, what I've noticed, that they did The Forever War, and there's like, I've done recorded a review of The Forever War, and I think it's the Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas, which is another science fiction-y kind of review show, they've done The Forever War, and I listened to that, and it was pretty good. And and also there's a podcast called Barely Literate, which is another science fiction book reviewing podcast, and they've done it. And also the latest Sword and Laser. No, is it the latest one? I can't remember. The Sword and Laser podcast, which is another science fiction book reviewing podcast. They do fantasy as well, as well as these other people. They do, they can do that too. So, so what I'm saying? Yes, they've all recorded podcast episodes about The Forever War. So what I'm thinking of doing is doing a science fiction book review podcast. Review podcast where I take all of these, my podcast as well, and all of these other podcasts, and look at the podcast that they've done on Forever War, which will be sort of like the control text. And then what I'll do is take that and then review all the different podcasts and talk about them. And yeah, so it'll be sort of like a little guide to science fiction book reviewing podcast, maybe. Anyway, that's just a little idea that I had there beforehand. What was I saying? Yeah, moving on. Anyway, so yeah, The Dispossessed. That's the reason why I read this book. God, that took a long time as well. I really need to actually get into this. So, the world of this book, I thought this was a follow-up to The Left Hand of Darkness. And it is a follow-up to The Left Hand of Darkness because it's written later and set in the same universe. But actually, this has this is actually set beforehand, before The Left Hand of Darkness, but it's set with the same kind of backdrop, and that is in the future, or sort of millions of years in the past, or hundreds of thousands of years in the past, humans were spread out from their sort of seeding planet across the galaxy, or across the local region of the galaxy, and then they got all disconnected and nobody knows what happened. But yeah, so what you can do is now when you head out into the world, all the local star systems with planets which can hold life all have different versions of humans on it, or different human civilizations and things like that. So there's this, and this is set when the Setians, I think it's the Setians, I think, no, this, the Setians are the people in this book, but there's the Hainish and the humans from Earth as well. So the Hainish and the humans, they're sort of just got together, and they've discovered these guys just 100 years before the events of this book, and so that's what you got set up there. The Ecumen, which is described in The Left Hand of Darkness, doesn't seem to have come about yet. It's set long before then, and there's a reason for that, which I'll get to later on in this novel. So what you have, like, as you can see here on the front of the book, it says here, it says on the back, A Tale of Two Worlds. So the setup is that you've got this one planet where humans lived, and then you've got this other planet, it's like a sister planet, well, it's called a moon, but now that we know that Pluto and, is it Charon? Charon is Pluto's moon? And they're actually not moons, they're co-planets. And they're co-planets because they're, I guess the point that they orbit about is outside of the diameter of the larger planet, which means they're twin planets. And that's what you have here. Two planets, I guess just around about the same size, exactly the same size, spinning around each other, going around the sun. And one of them's full of life and full of water and lots of oceans. And the other one is very dry and it has oceans, but there's life in the oceans, but it's all otherwise all quite dry and barren. It's a bit dune-like in a way. It even sounds a little bit like dune because it's called Anaras. Is the dry planet, and that's the one that was normally empty, and Eurus is the life-filled wet planet. And so what happened is that there was this political thinker and activist and resistance leader called Odo, and she said, hey, everyone should be anarchists. We should all be anarchists. And everyone's like, yeah, let's be anarchists. And there's a big anarchist movement set up. And it didn't work out very well. So what happened was that the government of Uras, which is the more Earth-like planet, said, hey, if you want to go and live on the moon and set up your own society there, go at it. Go for it. Yeah, and so that's what they did. They gave them spaceships. They all went off to from Uras up to Anaras, and a few million people lived up there in an anarchistic society. So what you've got is these two different worlds set up. These you've got like the capitalistic kind of setup down on Uras with the Ionians. I think it's the Ionians. That's sort of like the main culture that we find out about down there. And they're, yeah, capitalists and everything like that. And upstairs on the moon is the anarchist. And the way, and a lot of the book is, again, it's not a great amount of plot going on here and story going on. It's very much an exploration of the world, very much as it was set out in the introduction to the Left End of Darkness. Ursula K. Le Guin is like, she's going, okay, the main reason I'm doing this isn't really about the story. The reason I'm doing this isn't really about the science fiction elements. It's mainly to do with, hey, I'm setting up the world and I'm gonna see what can happen in this world, which is an admirable goal, and because it really, really worked in Left Hand of Darkness, and it works more. That goal works a lot more with The Dispossessed. However, I'd just like to mention this now. Just making an interesting world and exploring that world doesn't make for a fantastic storyline. And it's definitely the story comes secondary to the world building here. Now, just a little bit about the this anarchist world, because the capitalist world is pretty much, I wouldn't say it's sort of like modern Earth, because it's actually it doesn't have the same technological levels, or it's not infused with technology the way that the modern world is. Whereas it seems to be like, and the culture seems to be a little bit more sort of like 19th century rather than 20th century or early 20th century, because there's still like a big class divide. And I guess there is still a big class divide in lots of places in the world. But, you know, in the most modern place, there's still a disparate classes there and stuff like that. But up in the anarchistic world, anarchic world of Anaras, there everyone is equal and anyone can do whatever they want, and of course there's an anarchist and there's no laws, and it's just everyone there is set up to live with one another, and there's no money, and there's not really any family units, and there's no schools and stuff. And again, I don't really want to go into too much detail about this, because the book itself, I mean, if I was to explain it, I'd have to, you know, explain it by just reading out the entire book there, because that's what the book is about. So I'm not going to spoil it too much, but just to say that there are these two worlds. Now, it even says on the front, it goes, the magnificent epic of an ambiguous utopia. And I'm thinking, okay, which one is the utopia here? And of course, it's taken to mean that the anarchic world of Anaras, the Odo guided world, is meant to be the utopia, because everyone's free and anyone can do whatever they want. But it's ambiguous, because it turns out, of course, not everyone's free, and because it's like a desert world and there's no life there, everyone has to, you know, work from meal to meal, and everyone's being sent to different places that they don't want to be just to be able to keep working. And, you know, it's not actually a very nice place to live. And at one point, the main character Shevak, I'm not spoiling anything. He goes down to the other planet. He's the first person to do that since the founding of the Anaras society. And he's like, he gets into this speech and he says, yeah, it's rubbish up there. There's no food and there's no water, and you've got to break your back working and stuff like this. And so the idea of it being an ambiguous utopia, it's sort of like not quite sure what's going on. Also, later on in the book, we get another outside view of the world back down on Uras. And that is also described as a utopia from someone who isn't from this planet, which is full of life as well. It's like everyone's provided for. Nobody really can. I mean, people do go hungry, but they don't really go hungry. You know, there's some kind of welfare system set up there. So both societies don't come off as too bad, but you can really see the sympathies of Ursula K. Le Guin lie. You know, she's really talking about, hey, this might be how an anarchist society could run, but watch out for these things. And of course, that is also what's been explored here, is the things that might go wrong with this. So moving on, that's a bit about the world, actually quite a lot about the world. Moving on to the I made a note here. Oh, the language. Yes, they don't use a normal language. They have their own Esperanto going on. So a lot of it is talking about the language too. Like the plot. As I said, it's not really about the plot, but what you have is Shevak, and he grows up on the planet, and he's a physicist, but not just a physicist and a mathematician. He ties in to his physics, physics and maths, but also ethics and philosophy. And there's this whole kind of way of bringing all of this stuff together. And that's also what the book is about, his journey into putting together like the grand unified theory of everything. And also, once he's sort of done that, or once he's trying to do that, and he struggles to get stuff published, because, you know, you think, oh, in an anarchist kind of situation, anyone can publish anything, but of course, doesn't work out like that. So that's what the story is about, or that's what half of the story is about, because this book has got the structure that the first chapter is sort of like a setup chapter, and then alternating chapters. One tells a story, all the backstory, and then the next chapter will tell like what's happening now, and then the next one will tell a bit more of the backstory. And of course, where the two stories overlap is, of course, at the beginning of the book is chapter one and chapter Z, and then it goes through, and at the end of your book, you get chapter A. And I don't know, I'm getting confused now about how to do it. Anyway, the idea is you get alternating chapters, one telling the backstory and one telling the current story, which is actually the structure that I'm doing in my current novel, because I've already written one of these threads. I wrote it back in August and September, the backstory bit. I've already written that, and at the moment I'm writing the main storyline, or the big storyline, if you will. So those two are that's the way it's running, and I was actually very impressed by how it did that, for various reasons that I'll get into later. The unfortunate thing is that it does always have that thing that you know how the first story is going to end, because you know, or the backstory is going to end, because you know the backstory ends with him becoming the first person to head down to Uras and to go and meet the enemy, to meet the corruptors, to meet the profiteers, as they're called. So you know how it's going to end, and you know he's going to leave behind a wife and his family and his friends, and you know that the people back on, or he's leaving behind on Anaras, really don't want him to do that, and there's lots of friction there. So you're thinking, okay, well, this is going to be an interesting story of how he gets there. And then, of course, there's the big story, which you don't know how it's going to end, of him down on Uras, and what he's going to do there. The thing is, when he's at home, he spends a lot of the time just sort of hanging out, and we get lots of descriptions about how the world works, and we get these little vignettes and these little bits and pieces going on, and he does this and he does there and he goes there, and then there's a drought, and then there's this, and then there's that, and he meets this person, then he meets that person, and he hangs out with his childhood friends a bit, but he doesn't really seem to be doing a whole lot. He doesn't seem to be fighting for a whole lot. He is, of course, a physicist, so a lot of his story is taken up with him trying to come up with his theories, but not just coming up with his theories, but, you know, trying to sort of like get them published and all these other kinds of things. But unfortunately, that doesn't actually make it that interesting. I mean, there are some interesting bits, but he's not really fighting for anything except his own realization that his society might not be perfect. But we know it's not perfect, and we're going to find that out anyway, so I'd have liked to have had a little bit more for him to fight for. And once he realizes that it's not perfect, and he actually needs to do something, then it skips ahead 3 years over the stuff which I would have actually found really interesting to read about. And then what happens when he gets down onto the planet, onto Uras, he, of course, finds out a lot there, so he's our fresh eyes to see so we find out a lot about Uras. And of course, by that, because he's always contrasting it to what he knows about Anaras, we, of course, find out just as much about Anaras while the main character Shevak is down on Uras than we do when he's actually growing up on Anaras, you know. So it's this strange kind of setup there. I mean, well, it's not a strange kind of setup, it's very well done, it's very well explored. But the thing is, he does a whole lot of sitting around doing nothing. He's meant to be working out his, like I say, his grand unified theory, or his next big grand unified theory, and what's he going to do with it, what ramifications is going to happen with it. But like, for the first three quarters of the book, he's not actually doing very much. He's not actually getting on with anything. And there's not, it doesn't really seem to be a lot of people fighting against him. There's not a lot of conflict there. And then, like I say, in the backstory part, the conflict seems to be him against the society, but it's not really, because he doesn't realize that's what it is. I'm not sure. So it's a very, very slow book. And the plot never really kicked off. And even at the end, when it does kick off, sometimes when you get a slow book, again, like what was the book that I read the other day, which was a bit slow? Market Forces. I think that was even like the last episode that I did. But again, that started off a bit slow, and it had this same kind of thing. There's one guy getting into a new situation, and we find out how the world works, and he does this and he does that, and he gets a family, you know, and he's with family, and and I think, well, this is going to be, it must have a big, huge payoff at the end, and the payoff at the end really isn't all that massive, because we know what the payoff at the end of the backstory is going to be, and then the payoff at the main story just isn't that strong, which is a pity, because I really enjoyed the book and the world building and all that kind of stuff. But it never, like I say, it never really kicked off. And when it did kick off, it was just a bit easy. You know, it was, again, he goes, oh, I've got to do something. And then it's just handed to him and he's like, do this. And he's like, oh, okay. Bit strange. Anyway, the character of Shavek is sort of interesting. He does go through some change, but the character that he is at the beginning of the main storyline and the character that he is in within the first few chapters of the back storyline, he seems to be very similar. And you can think, oh, there's just a normal through thread going from like point A, and then he'll go through point B, point C, and then we're reading him at point D, and it's going to move on from there. Unfortunately, I didn't really see a whole lot of development, and then even then it was like he sort of went somewhere and then he sort of came back to it, and then he sort of went there again and then came back to it. So it's a sort of meandering kind of character development, which again doesn't actually make him very interesting. And again, a lot of the stuff that he's doing is in his head, which is nice. I like to hear about that and read about that and what he's thinking and what he's doing. But again, sometimes you just want a character to do a little bit more. Even though he's like the world or the universe's best physicist up until that point, he wasn't actually all that interesting. And some of the decisions that he makes, I'm just like, look, can't you do something a bit better? You're in like an anarchy. You can do whatever you want. And of course he doesn't. So it's a bit strange. He's a little bit bland, but I can forgive that for other stuff in the book. At least I think so. I could have just done with a bit more. Otherwise, the characters that he meets are all a bit a bit archetypal, and I sort of mentioned this in a few times with other books as well. Like here, you've got like the guy who's the rebel who goes mad because he writes this, and he's sort of like the voice in the wilderness calling out. And I'm like, okay, so there's sort of like your John the Baptist kind of guy. Well, not exactly that, but you know, you get that kind of guy going on, and then you get the woman, the wilder woman, and then you get the perfect woman a bit later on, and then down on the planet, you get the serving man, and you get this kind of person, and you get the enemy spy from the other side of the world, and it seemed, these positions seemed all a little bit too contrived, but again, that's the point of this book, I think, is to have people who are maybe slightly contrived stepping in and like talking to this character and challenging this political system in different ways. So I think it's, you know, they do their job perfectly well, and you can actually like them, and there are some times when you enjoy reading about them, but other times you just think, oh man, you could get on with this a little bit quicker, which I should be doing here with this podcast. Moving on to the again, I'm going to talk about a lot more about quite a few of these subjects later on when I get to the themes and the writing style. The technology here, it's quite a low level of technology, sort of like 1960s kind of stuff. You know, there's computers there, and there's lots of central computer gubbins and central computer controls. So I guess in the 60s, the computers are really coming online, and like maybe the banks are using computers. It's like, oh yeah, okay, so everything's going to be on computers, and this will be organized on computers, and that will be organized on computers. But again, it doesn't really factor into a huge amount, not a massive amount there. And again, up on Arras, because everything is so dry, and they're struggling for everything, you know, you get trains and dirigibles and radios, but that's about it, you know. And everything else seems to be done through manual labor, and there's not a whole lot of tech going on up there. The spaceships, again, they just sort of seem to miraculously work, and they suddenly miraculously have enough energy to run the spaceships between the two planets, but you know, I'll just let that go because they need to get from one place to the other. And then down on the other part, down on Uras, not on Anaras, they have the technology going on down there, but again, it's not focused on the technology, it's all about the politics. Very, very soft science fiction, except for the science that Shavek, the main character, our physicist, the kind of stuff that he comes up with. So there's this whole big bit about these two theories, which are, first of all, you've got linearity. Well, it's not linear. It's sort of like a sequential, sequency or something like that is the main overall theory of the time, that everything goes one ABC, ABC, or ABCDEFG, not back to ABC, sorry. So it's just continuingly like that. And that's the big theory. But then he comes up at one point with this other theory that other people have tried to formulate, but he makes the first big formulation of a theory called simulaneity. Man, I should maybe it's written on the back here. I should have written that down exactly what it's called. But everything happening simultaneously and everything informing everything else backwards and forwards in time and everything like that. So he does that at one point in the book, because the beginning of the main storyline is him. He's got this sort of, like I say, the grand unified theory. So we've got these two things going. I mean, these two different setups, and these are used to inform like the thematic explorations of it, of what's going on, which is actually quite nice, because Shield's Ladder, while being completely different from this book, which is here's also a fictional theoretical basis for the whole world, which I talked about that. I'm not going to go into now. But what is happening is that you are getting very much an exploration from the point of view of one of the main characters. Like, okay, the book is about the exploration of this theory, and by exploring this theory, I'm going to inform the characters. And by exploring this theory, then that's where the story later on in the book is going to come from. Whereas in this book, what you get is it's very much, okay, by talking about the politics and by talking about the character and by talking about personal responsibility and character development and relationships and all this kind of stuff, you can tie it into this theory. So what you're getting is lots of talk or lots of things. What am I trying to say? Lots of passages about Shevek thinking about the theory and about what it might mean and about what he can do with it and all these different kind of stuff, but nothing, there's no maths, there's no diagrams written about this. Unlike Shield's Ladder, which was always like, okay, this is a theory and this is it, this is this, this is it, this is this, and this is the implications of it. Oh, and here's some characters who are talking about it. Whereas here, it's sort of like, okay, here's a character, here's his struggle, here's his political views, here's everything else going on there, and we're going to take it into this simultaneous sequential naity. I don't know. Hey, there's more people viewing now. 8 people viewing, so say hi in the chat room. Anyway, so what was I going to say? Yes, so because this book is set before the Left Hand of Darkness and everything like that, you get the there's no Ansible at the beginning of the book, and of course this theory comes to the invention of the Ansible by the end of the novel, which is actually quite funny. And there's this really clever line in the book, whereas what he's doing is talking about what might be possible when I finish this theory and publish this theory. This is Shevek talking. It's like, I'm going to be able to make up like a kind of radio, which by spinning a thing here and by doing a jimmy-bock there and doing that kind of stuff, people will be able to talk from one side of the galaxy to the other instantaneously. And then one of the people say, a few minutes later or something, someone says, oh yeah, there's already this company who's making it, but they haven't quite made it yet, but they're talking about making it, and they're going to set it up, and then you'll provide the theory for it, and then they'll be able to use it. And he's like, wow, so they've already invented it and started making it before I've explained how it works. And they're like, yeah, that's the idea. And it's like, oh, very strange kind of thing. But then that's actually what's happened here with Ursula K. Le Guin. She's come up with this idea of the Ansible. And then later on, what she's done is she's gone back to, in the book, The Dispossessed, and then sort of laid out the ideas, or she's laid out the invention of it, even though she's already used it. And that's actually what happens here in the book as well. So it's a very strange kind of, but clever kind of thing that she's done there. But I'm not sure if it's intentional. Again, you can't. It's very strange to be able to read into books that much. Sort of like, okay, did she use the Ansible before she invented it? Yes, she did. And then she's talking about people using trying to make the Ansible before it has been invented. So moving on now. Next, oh yes, the writing structure. Oh, the writing style. Like I said before about the structure. The structure again plays into this kind of thematic exploration of stuff happening simultaneously and one after the other, and you know, of cause and effect and all this kind of different stuff going on by mixing the two storylines. Now, I'm not a big fan of non-linear storytelling unless it serves a purpose. Often they'll do it in films and you're just like, well, that that's a bit weird. And another novels do it. And of course, my first novel is extreme non-linearity, but I think it's a good thing there. Anyway, so what am I trying to say? Yes, so that's what you get in this book. And it's like everything that's happening now is dependent on the stuff that happens before. That's one of the themes that comes in then. You can't look at things individually. So it was actually very clever to do it that way. The thing is, maybe a little bit too clever, because the two stories, while they did inform each other, and they did, you know, the backstory informed what was happening in the main story, and the main story informed what was happening in the backstory, I don't really think that it added a huge amount to each other. Otherwise, but it otherwise worked very well. I thought it was a well done, but maybe just maybe a little bit too clever. I don't know. Anyway, so the writing style, though, is actually very good. I really enjoy the descriptions. I mean, I just hold up a page at random, spot the dialogue, no dialogue at all, you know, and you turn to another page, and it's like, spot the dialogue, and it's these big, long chapters of very well thought out prose and things. So, and open another page at random, and it's sort of like, yeah, more big, chunky bits. And I'm very impressed by how the action, you can read this huge, big chunk of writing, and but there's so much packed into it. Like she can fit like a year into a chapter, and that's very well done, and the description's all very well done. And yeah, I just really like the writing style. It's a little bit clunky at some points, but overall I enjoy it. There is this one part, though, where there's this like this break of a point of view. Shevak, he passes out, and then suddenly otherwise the entire book is told purely from his point of view, and if he's not there, it doesn't happen. You know, everything happens there, and then he passes out, and suddenly we get this little bit of information there. And this is the part 3/4 of the way through the book where I said it suddenly starts kicking into gear and things actually start happening. And I thought it was a little bit weird how that only took place, or that only started happening, you know, once we broke away from Shevak. So it's sort of like things were just happening to him rather than because of him. Although it was happening because of him, it was almost like accidentally happening because of him. I don't know. So that was a bit strange. That one break of the point of view seemed to be a little bit weak. Anyway, moving on to the last thing I normally talk about here, which is the themes of the book. Now, as I said before, this book is very much an exploration of a political system. It's sort of like, hey, here's how a world could work. It might not work like this, but, you know, here it is. So I don't actually really want to talk too much about that, except or about the like her ideas of political ideas, except that she's come up with a good way of setting this in bout. It's like, okay, so we have a political situation, and it even states this quite explicitly in the book, saying the only way that we can have this work, and it would never work if it was surrounded by other people, and it would never work if like people could be greedy, and it would never work if this. So by setting her anarchistic place on like a remote moon where there are no enemies, you know, there are no external enemies, and there are no, you know, there's almost no way for anyone to be greedy without sort of harming other people. You know, so the tragedy of the commons, which is the big thing here, you know, it's sort of like it's the commons are very, very small, and the tragedy will come very, very quickly. You know, so that all that idea is set out very well, and it really reminds me of conversations that I have with a friend of mine called Florian here, and he is he's like very, very, very much a lefty, and he's very, very socialist, and he always expounds on this idea called the guaranteed minimum basic income. I can't think of exactly the right terms of this. The idea is that everyone in the country should be given enough money to live on. Everyone should get that amount of money, and then there's like ways of, you know, taxing all kind of produce and taxing money spent. But once you tax the money spent, that means everyone will get a certain amount of income, which means that anyone can then do anything they want to, which means that the worst jobs will get paid in the end the most, because you don't need to do them to live. So, you know, if you want to be a someone who works like doing a menial job, that'll actually become a very highly paid job because nobody wants to do it. So to get the work done, people will be willing to pay for it. And the jobs which, you know, would normally get paid highly, like being an actor or these other like artists or these other big high paying jobs, those which everybody would want to be able to do. Everyone wants to be able to do them, but now, like, everyone wants to be able to do them, and the top ones get paid for at, like, high rates. Those people wouldn't have to be paid to do them. So if you wanted to become a poet, you could be like this. And there's lots of reasons why I think this is all a very, very bad idea, and lots of reasons that I think it would be a good idea. And I'd love to write maybe a science fiction book exploring this in a sort of like Ursula K. Le Guin style, to actually just explore like an entire political setup, because I've not read any science fiction about the basic minimum income idea. And to be honest, for me to write a novel about that, or even a story about that, I'd have to probably do a lot more reading of my own. Anyway, what it comes down to is that when I'm having these conversations, he'll be talking about different stuff, and I'll be saying, yeah, this is all good, but the only way this could ever work is if it happened in isolation, because everybody would want to come into this country and nobody would want to spend any money in this country. So it would become like, I don't know, I can't even think of a country, but, you know, like the place where everyone wants to live but nobody wants to spend any money, because everyone wants to get the guaranteed basic income, but nobody wants to spend their money there, because by extension, everything there would cost a lot of money, or like any non-luxury item, or any item which was a luxury, sorry, would cost a huge amount. And, you know, there's massive amounts of difficulties with this. And I actually said to him, like, the only way this could possibly work is if there was no alternative, if you couldn't leave the system and if nobody could get into the system. And so that's what he always comes down to. And he always, like, admits that. That's probably quite right. And that's the same thing which, of course, happens to a lot of these political systems that are set up. Not even political systems, but, like, yesterday was the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and you've got this political system, but the only way it could work is if people couldn't leave. And this basically guaranteed income thing is like the only way it could possibly work is if nobody was allowed in, you know, so you get this different kind of stuff. So setting up a whole society on a remote moon where you can't leave and you can't get in there, that would be really bad. And the other way is that you can't set it up using people who disagree. I mean, you could never set up like the Odo society where people wouldn't want to be there, and you could never set up sort of like a basic guaranteed minimum income place with people who wouldn't want to be there. So you've got to, and that's what happens in this novel as well, it's sort of like only the people who want to opt in, they do opt in. Unfortunately, later on, more people want to opt in, but they've closed their doors, which is a bit of a pity, but that's the only way that the societies could work. And of course, that's what it is. This book is about. It's actually communication between the two different kind of communities and two different political setups. So there's, you know, there's a big thematic kind of stuff, but that's just one point that really stuck out to me while reading this. The second point that stuck out is the way that the way that Shevak is informed by his mathematics. I just want to read out this section where I folded the page over here of this edition, 269. And he's talking, you know, he's talking about all of his different things, and he's talking about how he was together with his wife, and then he got separated from his wife for a long time, and then they got back together again. And it says this, he goes, "So, looking back on the last 4 years, Shevak saw them not as wasted, but part of the edifice that he and Takfa were building with their lives." Takfa was his wife. He says, "The thing about working with time, instead of against it," he thought, "is that it is not wasted. Even pain counts." And that really hit me, because I've just gone through a similar, well, not similar, an opposite kind of experience with my own relationship, I guess you could put it that way, is that I was with my girlfriend for about 4.5 years, knew her for about 5 years, and then we broke up. So it's sort of like the opposite of Shevak, what he was with when he was separated from his wife for that amount of time. And then, you know, but he says that wasn't wasted. It's part of the edifice that he builds with his life, and he's working with time. And that's really strange, because when I broke up with Pola, someone, a good friend of mine, you know, I was chatting online and chatting about it to some good friends, and, you know, I was talking, man, it's a hard thing to go through, you know. Actually, someone emailed me the other day, they said, "Wow, this is a big thing in your life, and you've not talked about it too much on the podcast." And I guess it's because it's quite, you know, still quite raw. I mean, it's been 3 months now, but it's still a little bit raw. Anyway, one of my friends in the UK said, it's like, oh, it's sort of like, ah, oh, now, you know, you'll say to her, "Can I have the last 5 years of my life back?" But for me, it's just the complete opposite, because the last 5 years of my life have been like the best, and I'm not kidding about it, the best 5 years of my entire life. And now that I've split up, it's not, I don't want those years back, because I'm working with time instead of against it, and it's just part of that. I said the edifice that I was building, like the thing that I'm going through, is part of me, and there's no way I can like be separated from that. And also, I very much agree with this view of life, that everything that's happened in my life contributes to the person that I am now. And even, and I've talked about this before, I'm sure, on the podcast, I don't know how much I've gone into it, but I was brought up as a hardcore born-again Christian, and I'm not that anymore. But that's still a massive part of my life. That was like the first, maybe like for a big part, the first 17 years of my life. And then there was this transition period where I wasn't much of a Christian anymore. And now I'm an atheist, you know, and I have been for many years. But that first 17 years of my life, I can't see it as a wasted part of my life. And I can't let it be a wasted part of my life. So even to this day, one of my favorite hobbies and one of my favorite things to do is actually use my knowledge of the Bible that I got through looking at it as a Bible believing inerrantist sort of like kind of Christian, and now I look at it and study the Bible from a much more like literature kind of point of view, historical point of view, and critical point of view, which for me is very important. And that's what one of the books that I'm going to be taking away with me on this 8-week journey is a Bible, and by the end of it, I hope to have some kind of dissertation on a subject, and hopefully I can put that towards maybe a master's degree in biblical higher criticism in the future. I mean, I'm going to look into it, but that's one of the things that I think I can do with my life. But I can't see that point where I believe the opposite of what I believe now as a wasted part of my life. It must be, it has to inform my life now, and I have to work with it in the same way that all of the other hobbies that I've ever done and all the other things that I've done in the past and haven't, and I don't do anymore, or I disagree with my past views, or the things I aren't part of my life anymore. I don't see them as wasted, and I have to keep going with them. And that's why, you know, I work doing a television, you know, I work doing television production for 2 years. Now I don't do that anymore. I'm a juggler. And I'm also, you know, did music at university and did all that kind of stuff, but I still work with them all the time. It would be a waste of me to move on from those kind of things and to see them as wasted. So that was a big thing which hit me quite personally about this book, about seeing your entire life as a single object. And that is what I do. And I think that's why this book resonated with me. Or maybe that's why the character of Shevek, while a little bit bland and a little bit not that interesting, I don't really want to identify with him too much in that way, but this attitude in life where he has it sort of like, yeah, this is me, and this is what I'm going to go through. And again, that's what I, you know, just tie it back to me being single now. Like, I've had a really, really bad breakup in the past, like super bad kind of breakup. But again, that is part of me. I'm not going to go into that story. And also the relationship that I've had now is part of me, and I can't regret it. And I can't hold it against Pola for dumping me and me still now 3 months later being in love with her. But again, I just got to work with that and use it for good. So I think that's probably the most I've talked about my own philosophy in life on my podcast. Maybe, I don't know. I've probably talked about different bits and pieces. But this, for me, really stood out in this book, and I thought I'd better talk about it now. So, I think that's about it, all I want to say about it. Generally, not a whole lot of story. Characters aren't that interesting. Very good exploration into the societies that are there, although probably not that believable. I don't like the motivations of people on the moon. It's sort of like the only way this society could work was if it was in a place where you could literally you had to be that way, otherwise you died, you know, unless it was something like that. So that's the only way I can see it working. So it's not that believable. The science in it is a bit wishy-washy. The politics I don't really agree with, but it's good food for thought. And again, that's what it comes down to. I think if you're going to write a book which is a political statement, this is just at another level completely than A Brave New World. But then maybe in another 50 years, you could look back at this book and go, oh, is it really that? Anyway, I look forward to listening to the science fiction and politics episode from Courtney Brown is it Courtney Brown? I can't remember his name. Yeah, the professor there at Emory University and his lectures and his workshop series that he was doing, his classroom series. So I look forward to listening to that one, and I do recommend that podcast too. Otherwise, I will give this book, it's certainly not as good as Left Hand of Darkness, not by a long, long way, I don't think, because that actually, I cared about the relationships and I cared about the people and I cared about the story. There seemed to be some real stakes involved, whereas this, it's just a political statement. Well, it's not just that, but like... a big half of the book is, and the other half of the book I also enjoyed, but it's not up there among the best novels that I've read this year, not even the best novels that I've read for this podcast in the last 2 years. So I'm going to only give it 3.5 stars. Again, I think it's probably, again, it's better, I think, in a lot of ways than a lot of the books that I've given 4.5 stars or even 4 stars to. But that's not what it's about. It's about personal enjoyment, and it is a little bit of a drag at places and a hard read. But also, yeah, if you're going to read Ursula K. Le Guin's, definitely go with Left Hand of Darkness before this one. And it's a bit strange because this was written after that. I'd have thought she would have tried to have put as much of the strength that she had in that book, in Left Hand of Darkness, into this book, just as a quick compare and contrast there. Because that book was also about a society that would only work the way it did work because it was very cold, you know, and it was a very slow kind of place, and the whole setup there was very cold, and now it's very dry, you know. And I'd have thought she'd have learnt from that previous book and got in the story and the character and the journey that these two characters go on together. Was in here, like Shevek, he gets this relationship and it's just perfect, and then it's sort of like they're apart for ages, but that's good too, and then they get back together and that's good, and then they have kids and that's fine too, you know. I just want a little bit more in there to chew on rather than philosophy and political philosophy. But for what it was very good. So 3.5 stars. The next book that I'm going to read, I've got that one called Blindsight on my iPod here. And also, I've, like I say, thinking maybe on the next ship, I've got 19 days. And I'm wondering if 19 days is long enough to get to churn my way through Atlas Shrugged, because I'm also writing a novel at the same time. So, but I do have 7 days at sea, and sea days are generally long and boring. So it's like get up, eat, maybe sit in a pool for a bit, eat. Hang out in the evening, eat, see a show, maybe perform in a show, eat a bit more, drink in the bar with the guys on board, eat a bit, and then go to bed. So like other projects, like the podcasts and writing music and writing and reading, they fill up my time no end on these long journeys. So maybe I'll have enough time to do that. Anyway, I've been going on, what, like 45 minutes now. So I'll wrap that up. So there's a few options that I have. Oh, also, I've got the book... the Darkness That Comes Before. It's a fantasy novel. I'll be taking that with me to read. Also, I had this book called is it Galactic North by Alistair Reynolds, and I started it last night, and it's a short story collection. So again, that would have been the second time I got caught out with a collection of stories rather than a novel from Alistair Reynolds. So no wonder I was like, oh, I've not read this novel before, I don't know about this. And of course, yeah, it's not a novel, so of course I haven't read it. Anyway, so that's it. So I'll catch. Oh no! Final thing. Yeah, like I say, if you think The Dispossessed is good, similar books. Ah, oh, no, I've gone over that. You know, check out the other political books that I've been reading now, and also look at the playlist for the podcast, Science Fiction and Politics, by Science Fiction and Politics course. I'm not quite sure what the podcast is, but search for it on iTunes, look up that list and read some of the titles from there. I think that's probably the best way to go about this. So yeah, you can follow me on Twitter for previous live broadcasts and other travel bits and pieces and all my other stuff. I'm at Luke Burge there. You can check out my blog, lukeburge.com/blog, and I'm posting photographs and videos and music and writing stuff there. Also goodreads.com/LukeBurge for book recommendations. Follow me there to see my progress on different books, which is the best way to do it. And if you want to recommend me books, that's the way that most people are doing it now. But keep sending in the emails. Those are the things that really keep me going, is the emails. And also, I pretty much get into a discussion with about half of the people that email me. So ask me a question, and I do spend time replying and get into debates there and discussions there. And sometimes I'll do it live onto the podcast, but not this week. So luke@juggler.net is the way to get in contact there. Otherwise, thanks a lot for sticking with it. It's been a long podcast this time. And thanks for letting me get a little bit personal at the end there. Otherwise, see you later.